pull up a chair. I want to take you somewhere warm and green and dangerous. A dirt airfield hacked out of the jungle near a town called Tonggu in Burma in the fall of 1941. The monsoon has just let up. The air is thick enough to drink, and parked in a ragged line under camouflage netting are a couple dozen fighter planes with something painted on their noses that nobody had ever really seen before. A mouth. A grinning, snarling shark's mouth, teeth and all, wrapped right around the air intake under the propeller. This is Radio Hangar. I'm Taildragger, and this is the hangar, where we tell the stories behind the airplanes. And today we're going to talk about a bunch of American pilots who went off to fight a war their own country hadn't entered yet. Flying an airplane everybody else had already written off, the Flying Tigers. Now before I get rolling, let me tell you who's keeping the lights on in the hangar today. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com. Aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo, private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. And I'll tell you, the men in this story earned theirs the hard way. Every coin tells a story. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. All right, let's set the scene properly. To understand the Tigers, you have to understand one man first. Claire Lee Chenault. A hard-faced Louisiana country boy with a jaw like a cinder block and a voice ruined by years of open cockpits and cheap cigarettes. Chenault was an Army pursuit pilot in the 1920s and 30s, and he was a genuine thinker about air combat. Trouble was, the Army brass in those days had fallen in love with the idea that the bomber would always get through, that fighters were yesterday's news. Chenault disagreed, loudly, in writing, to people who outranked him. So by 1937, half-deaf, worn out, and passed over, he retired from the Army as a captain. And then he did something a little crazy. He took a job working for Chiang Kai-shek, building an air force for China, which was already 3 years into a brutal war with Japan. Now here's where it gets interesting. Chenault spent those years in China doing something none of the American or British planners had bothered to do. He watched the Japanese fly. He set up spotters. He took notes. He learned the enemy's airplanes cold. He learned that the Japanese fighters, the ones everybody would come to call Zeros, were light and nimble and could outturn anything in the sky. Turn with one of those and you would lose, and losing meant dying. But Chenault also saw the weakness. Those Japanese fighters were built light. No armor for the pilot. No self-sealing fuel tanks. They were a rifle with no helmet. Fast in a turn, but not especially fast in a dive. And terribly fragile, if you could just get your guns on them for half a second. So he built a whole way of fighting around that. Don't dogfight. Never turn with them. Come down from above. Fast in pairs. Hit them hard in one slashing pass and keep going. Dive, shoot, dive away. Use your strength against their weakness. It sounds obvious now. In 1941, it was heresy, because every young fighter pilot in the world had grown up dreaming of the swirling one-on-one dogfights of the First World War. Chenault threw all that out. Now he needed two things. Airplanes and pilots. And this is the part that still amazes me. The airplane he got his hands on was the Curtiss P-40. Call it the Warhawk, the Tomahawk, depending on the model. And I have to be honest with you, the P-40 was not the belle of the ball. It was heavy. It had a big Allison inline engine that ran out of breath at high altitude. It couldn't climb with a Zero, and it couldn't turn with a Zero. British and American pilots in other theaters were already grumbling that it was second rate. But that big nose held a strong engine that loved to dive. The airplane was built like a bank vault, with armor plate behind the pilot's seat and on the later ones, protected fuel tanks. It carried a heavy battery of machine guns. It could take a beating and bring you home. In other words, the P-40 had every single quality Chenault's tactics needed, and none of the weaknesses his tactics avoided. He didn't have a great airplane. He had exactly the right airplane. There's a lesson in that, and not just for warbirds. These particular P-40s came to China through a tangle of politics and horse trading, 100 of them, machines originally headed for Britain that got diverted. And when they arrived, the ground crews found the shark mouth. Now, Chenault's men did not invent that snarling shark face. They'd seen a photograph of a Royal Air Force squadron flying P-40s in the North African desert wearing the same design. And those Brits had borrowed it from German pilots before them. But it fit the long, drooping nose of the P-40 like it was made for it. The Chinese, who'd never seen a shark, looked up and thought the noses looked like tigers, and a name was born. Now the pilots. Chenault couldn't recruit openly because, remember, America was neutral. This was the summer before Pearl Harbor. So the whole thing ran through a quiet wink and a nod operation. young men were released from the Army, the Navy, the Marines, on the understanding they'd sign on with a private company to go fly in China. Officially, they were civilians, crop dusters, missionaries, anything but soldiers. They came for a lot of reasons, some for adventure, some to get out of a boring stateside assignment. And plenty of them, let's be honest, for the money, because the deal included a bounty, a bonus, reportedly $500 for every Japanese airplane they shot down. That was real money in 1941. What they got was tengu, mud, heat, snakes in the barracks, dysentery, food that would turn your stomach, and a demanding, growling old man running them through his tactics day after day after day, drilling them until diving and shooting and breaking away was something their hands did without asking their brains. A lot of them thought he was nuts. A few of them washed out and went home before a shot was ever fired. And then on December 7, 1941, everything changed. Pearl Harbor, now America was in it. And this odd little band of not-quite-civilian pilots in the Burmese jungle suddenly found themselves as one of the only Allied fighting forces anywhere that was trained, in place, and ready to hit back at Japan. Their first real combat came just 2 weeks later, over Kunming, in China, on December 20th. Japanese bombers came in expecting the usual, an undefended city they could pound at will. Instead, the Tigers came down out of the sun, the way Chenault had taught them. Dove through the formation, guns hammering, and kept right on going. The bombers scattered, several never made it home, and the men on the ground, Chinese civilians who had spent years watching bombers arrive with nothing to stop them, stood in the streets and cheered as the wreckage fell. Picture that for a second. After years of taking it, somebody finally hit back, and it was these ragtag Americans in their shark-nose cast-offs. But the fight that made the legend was Rangoon. The Tigers had a detachment down at Rangoon, in Burma, defending the port and the Burma Road, that thin, twisting lifeline of a supply route that kept China in the war. And for about 10 weeks, a tiny handful of P-40s, sometimes only a dozen or 15 serviceable airplanes on any given day, stood against wave after wave after wave of Japanese raids. Bombers and fighters by the hundreds over the course of the campaign. Think about the arithmetic of that. A dozen tired airplanes and their exhausted pilots, taking off two and three and four times a day, climbing for altitude, diving in, breaking away, landing, refueling, rearming while the sweat ran off the mechanics in that jungle heat, and going right back up again. The mechanics, by the way, are the unsung heroes of this whole story. There were never enough spare parts. They robbed wrecked airplanes to keep flyable ones flying. They patched bullet holes with whatever they had. When a P-40 came home shot to ribbons, those men worked through the night by lantern light to have it ready at dawn. No warbird ever flew without a crew chief's grease under its skin, and it was never more true than here. Now here's the honest part, the part the movies always smoothed over. The kill numbers the Tigers claimed were staggering, and historians have argued ever since about the exact count, the way they always do. Confirming a kill in the chaos of a diving fight over jungle is never clean, but even the conservative, careful modern reckonings are astonishing. This handful of pilots destroyed hundreds of Japanese aircraft, and they did it while losing only a small number of their own men in air combat. Let that sink in, a retired, half-deaf captain that the Army had shelved, flying an airplane that everybody said was mediocre, with pilots nobody else wanted to spare, produced one of the most lopsided records in the history of air fighting, because he'd done his homework, because he understood his machine's strengths and his enemy's weaknesses, and he never, ever let his young men be talked into fighting the other fellow's fight. There's a truth in there that goes way beyond 1941. Know your airplane, know its limits. Fly the fight it can win, not the one your ego wants. The American Volunteer Group didn't last long, just about 7 months of combat, all told. In the summer of 1942, the group was officially dissolved and folded into the regular Army Air Forces. Some of the pilots stayed and put the uniform back on. A lot of them, worn down and disillusioned with how they'd been treated, went home. Chenault himself stayed in China, pinned on a general's stars at last, and commanded American air power there for the rest of the war. The man the peacetime army couldn't find a use for turned out to be exactly the man that war needed, but those 7 months, those bought something you can't measure in a ledger. At the lowest, darkest moment, when the news from the Pacific was nothing but defeat and retreat and surrender, here was a story Americans could hold on to. Ordinary young men in an airplane held together with baling wire and stubbornness, winning the shark mouth became a symbol of it. You still see that grinning nose today on warbirds at every air show, on the noses of a 10 warthogs, painted by units that trace their heritage straight back to those Tigers. And that's really why I wanted to tell you this one. Because when you're standing on the ramp at a fly-in this summer, and you see a P-40 taxi by, that big Allison rumbling and popping, that long shark-toothed nose swinging toward you. I want you to know what you're looking at, not just a pretty warbird. You're looking at proof that the right idea, flown by ordinary people in an underdog machine, can turn the whole thing around. That airplane isn't the best fighter of its war. It never was, and that's exactly the point. The story I told you today leans on Chenault's own memoir, on the histories kept alive by the folks who restore and fly these airplanes, and on the work of the wartime historians who've spent lifetimes sorting the legend from the record. If you want to dig deeper, and I hope you do, come find us at radiohangar.com. Next time you see that shark mouth, tip your wing to it. Those young men earned it. This has been The Hangar. I'm Taildragger. Keep the greasy side down.